Deuteronomy chapter 2, verse 1, which in the Red Church Bibles is on page 179. Page 179. Then we turned back and set out towards the wilderness along the route to the Red Sea, as the Lord had directed me. For a long time we made our way around the hill country of Seir. Then the Lord said to me, "You have made your way around this hill country long enough. Now turn north. Give the people these orders. You are about to pass through the territory of your relatives, the descendants of Esau, who live in Seir. They will be afraid of you, but be very careful. Do not provoke them to war, for I will not give you any of their land, not even enough to put your foot on. I have given Esau the hill country of Seir as his own. You are to pay them in silver for the food you eat and the water you drink. The Lord your God has blessed you in all the works of your hands. He has watched over your journey through this vast wilderness. These 40 years the Lord your God has been with you, and you have not lacked anything." So we went on past our relatives, the descendants of Esau, who live in Seir. We turned from the Arabah road, which comes up from Elath and Ezion-Geber, and travelled along the desert road to Moab. Then the Lord said to me, "Do not harass the Moabites or provoke them to war, for I will not give any part of their land. Give you any part of their land. I have given Ar to the descendants of Lot as a possession." The Emites used to live there. Sorry, I've gone on a bit far. Stop at verse 8. The desert road to Moab. And now we move on to verse 24. "Set out now and cross the Arnon Gorge. See, I have given into your hand Sihon the Amorite, king of Heshbon, and his country. Begin to take possession of it and engage him in battle. This very day I will begin to put terror and the fear of you on all the nations under heaven. They will hear reports of you and will tremble and be in anguish because of you. From the desert of Kedemoth I sent messengers to Sihon, king of Heshbon, offering peace and saying, 'Let us pass through your country. We will stay on the main road. We will not turn aside to the right or to the left. Sell us food to eat and water to drink for the price in silver. Only let us pass through on foot, as the descendants of Esau, who live in Seir, and the Moabites, who live in Ar, did for us, until we cross the Jordan into the land our God is giving us.' But Sihon, king of Heshbon, refused to let us pass through, for the Lord your God had made his spirit stubborn and his heart obstinate in order to give him into your hands, as he has now done. The Lord said to me, 'See, I have begun to deliver Sihon and his country over to you. Now begin to conquer and possess the land.' When Sihon and his army came out to meet us in battle at Jahaz, the Lord our God delivered him over to us, and we struck him down, together with his sons and his whole army. At that time, we took all his towns and completely destroyed them, men, women, and children. We left no survivors, but the livestock and the plunder from the towns we had captured we carried off for ourselves, from Aroer on the rim of the Arnon Gorge, and from the town in the gorge as far as Gilead. Not one town was too strong for us. The Lord our God gave us all of them, but in accordance with the command of the Lord our God, you did not encroach on any of the land of the Ammonites, neither the land along the course of the Jabbok, nor that around the towns in the hills." And now we move on to chapter 3 and verse 21. Chapter 3, verse 21. "At that time I commanded Joshua, 'You have seen with your own eyes all that the Lord your God has done to these two kings. The Lord will do the same to all the kingdoms over there where you are going. Do not be afraid of them. The Lord your God himself will fight for you. At that time I pleaded with the Lord, Sovereign Lord, you have begun to show to your servant your greatness and your strong hand. For what God is there in heaven or on earth who can do the deeds and mighty works you do? Let me go over and see the good land beyond the Jordan, that fine hill country and Lebanon. But because of you, the Lord was angry with me and would not listen to me. That is enough, the Lord said. Do not speak to me any more about this matter. Go up to the top of Pisgah and look west and north and south and east. Look at the land with your own eyes, since you are not going to cross this Jordan. But commission Joshua and encourage and strengthen him, for he will lead this people across and will cause them to inherit the land you will see. So we stayed in the valley near Beth Peor.
Thank you very much, Jeff. We'll do keep that passage in front of you. It will become clear in a little bit why we've not read all of it, why we've read little sections of it. Don't worry, you won't miss out. Last week, I had probably the hardest moment of my parenting life so far. It had been one of those days where emotions were flying all over the place, and one of our children didn't like what I was asking them to do, and they really lost their temper with me, and so they started hitting and kicking me and screaming at me. So I took them to their bedroom to try and help them to calm down and to talk about it a little bit. And as I put my child in their bed, they lost it even more with me. And out of their mouth came these heart-wrenching words shouted at me, "You're evil." They are words that you never want to hear as a parent, aren't they? When you're trying your hardest to love and care for your child, and it feels like it's chucked back in your face, "You're evil." Well, in many ways, that's what we saw last week in Deuteronomy, isn't it? We saw the video replay of the first generation who reached the edge of the promised land, and yet they lost sight of who God is. They doubted his goodness and his faithfulness, and they stopped putting their trust in his promises, and they forfeited the blessing of entering the land. Even now, I'm just beginning to see how outrageous that rebellion was. It's as if they shouted at God, "You're evil." Look back to verse 27 of chapter 1. It says, "You grumbled in your tents and said, 'The Lord hates us. So he's brought us out of Egypt to deliver us into the hands of the Amorites to destroy us.'" Which, when you see everything that God had done for them, is absolutely unbelievable, isn't it? Moses gave us three pictures last week to remind God's people of all that God had done for them. He reminded them that he was the Lord who fought for them, who rescued them from slavery in Egypt by his mighty hand, by his victory. He reminded them that he was the Father who carried them, providing all that they needed, keeping them safe in the wilderness. And he was the God who guided them, leading them by fire and cloud from camp to camp, all the way to the edge of the promised land. And after all the Lord had done for them, they threw it back in his face. He prepared the promised land for them as a gift, which he was giving them. And like a spoiled brat with a birthday present, they chucked it in the mud. And yet I think that everything that happens, as we see in chapter 1, makes what happens in chapter 2 and 3 even more amazing. Because what we see in chapter 2 and 3 is God showing his people once more that he is a God who can be trusted, who is faithful, that they can take him at his word. You might expect God at this point to give up on his people. I've done all of this for you, and yet look how you repay me. You might expect him to just leave them, but he doesn't. He graciously, slowly teaches them again. And we're going to see him do that through five interactions with surrounding nations. As firstly, we see God is the king of the whole world. You might be wondering why I broke up the reading like I did. And that's because what we see in this section of Deuteronomy is that once you've heard one account, you've heard them all. In this section, we have the same pattern repeated again and again with different nations. We see that firstly with three nations that Moses gets the Israelites to pass through without taking anything. They start in chapter 2, God's people wandering around the wilderness again. Because of their sin in not obeying, that whole generation forfeited the blessing of entering the promised land. And yet even in the wilderness, we see God's gracious hand, don't we? Look with me to chapter 2, verse 7. It says, "The Lord your God has blessed you in all the work of your hands. He has watched over your journey through this vast wilderness. These 40 years, the Lord your God has been with you, and you have not lacked anything." Even as they face God's discipline at their rebellion, he is still watching over them, blessing them, providing for them. They've lacked nothing, because amazingly, that is what God's like. He is a generous father. As Moses told him told God's people that he was, he is showing himself to be again. Even when his people shout, "You're evil," in his face, he still cares for them. He still keeps them, because that is in his nature to do so. But as I said before, we see three times the Lord telling his people to pass through nations peacefully. So the first time we see it is in verse 4, which we had read for us. Look down with me to chapter 2, verse 4. It says, "Give the people these orders. You're about to pass through the territory of your relatives, the descendants of Esau, who live in Seir. They will be afraid of you, but be very careful. Do not provoke them to war, for I will not give you any of their land, not even enough to put your foot on. I have given Esau the hill country of Seir as his own." Again, we see it at verse 9, a different nation, same pattern. Verse 9, "The Lord said to me, 'Do not harass the Moabites or provoke them to war, for I will not give you any part of their land. I have given Ar to the descendants of Lot as a possession.'" And then a third time, verse 19, "When you come to the Ammonites, do not harass them or provoke them to war, for I will not give you possession of any land belonging to the Ammonites. I have given it as a possession to the descendants of Lot." There's a pattern in all three, isn't there? Do not provoke them to war. I haven't given you this land. It's not yours because I've given it to another nation as a possession. Do you see the message that God's people are meant to get? It's not very subtle, is it? God is the king of the whole world. Each nation that has land only has it because the Lord has given it to them. Every boundary line has been drawn by God. He decides who lives in a land and for how long. No matter how complicated a battle or a conflict seems, God is in control of the outcome. He gives each nation their piece of ground, even down to the size of a footprint. This is the type of thing that you could really wind up a geography or a history teacher with, isn't it? The question comes, how was the border between France and Germany drawn up? Answer, the Lord marked it out. You can imagine them getting more and more irate, can't you? But it's true. God is the king of the whole world. And we're also meant to see how it all happened as well. Look with me to chapter 2, verse 20. It says, that too was considered a land of the Rephaites who used to live there. But the Ammonites called them Zamzamites. They were a people strong and numerous and as tall as the Anakites. The Lord destroyed them from before the Ammonites, who drove them out and settled in their place. The Lord had done the same for the descendants of Esau, who lived in Seir, when he destroyed the Horites from before them. They drove them out and have lived in their place to this day. Before the Lord gave the Ammonites their land, the Zamzamites lived there. They were giants like the Anakites, but the Lord destroyed them from before the Ammonites. And before Esau was in Seir, well, the Horites used to live there, but they drove them out because the Lord had given it over to them. What we see here is that God is slowly teaching this new generation that wherever they put their feet, no matter how far they go, he is still Lord of that land. He is in control of when a nation defeats another nation and replaces them. Even nations that don't recognize him as God still have him to thank for all they have. And why do God's people need to know that? Well, as they prepare to step into the promised land and take possession of it, God wants them to know that it's his land, that he decides who lives there, and he gives it and he takes it away, and so they can trust him as they go in and take it. He's given other nations who are not his own people their land, even driving out giants like the Anakites, who their fathers were too scared to face because they were giants. So he will surely give them this good land. This slow, repeated reminder, three times the same thing happens, is God's gracious teaching to show them that they can step out and take the land, trusting in his promises. That with God on their side, they do not need to fear, because he is the king of the whole world. Nothing happens without his say-so, and nothing can get in the way of his plans. It's a helpful reminder for us as well, isn't it? God is the king of the whole world. Not as we go in and take land in battle, but as we go into the world to live and speak for him, he is in control of all that takes place. There is not a place, not a footprint, where he is not king and lord, where he is not in control of all that takes place. In the workplace, in our street, at home or abroad, he is the king of the whole world. And that should give us confidence to live by his word and tell others about this king, because he is in control of the outcome. And he delights to graciously open blind eyes and save people. Each of us here is living proof of that. So we see here that he is the king of the whole world. And so secondly, the call is don't fear the future. Don't fear the future. We had in our reading, didn't we, the defeat of King Sihon of Hezbon. Well, look with me now to chapter 3, verse 1, where we see the defeat of another king. Next, we turned and went up along the road towards Bashan, and Og, king of Bashan, with his whole army marched out to meet us in battle at Edrei. The Lord said to me, do not be afraid of him, for I have delivered him into your hands, along with his whole army and his land. Do to him what you did to Sihon, king of the Amorites, who reigned in Heshbon. So the Lord our God also gave into our hands Og, king of Bashan, and all of his army. We struck them down, leaving no survivors. At that time we took all his cities. There was not one of the 60 cities that we did not take from them. The whole region of Argob, Og's kingdom in Bashan, all these cities were fortified with high walls and with gates and bars, and there were also a great many unwalled villages. We completely destroyed them, as we had done with Sihon, king of Heshbon, destroying every city, men, women, and children, but all the livestock and the plunder from their cities we carried off for ourselves. So at that time we took from these two kings of the Amorites the territory east of the Jordan, from the Arnon Gorge as far as Mount Hermon. Hermon is called Syrian by the Sidonians. The Amorites call it Senea. We took all the towns of the plateau and all Gilead and all Bashan as far as Salekar and Edrei, towns of Og's kingdom in Bashan. Og, king of Bashan, was the last of the Rephaites. His bed was decorated with iron and was more than 9 cubits long and 4 cubits wide. It is still in Rabbah of the Ammonites. King Og's bed sounds appealing to me. It would have been more than 13 feet long and 6 feet wide. But I can guarantee even with that bed, when the kids come in, I would be left hanging off the edge of the bed. But the question comes, why are we talking about a big bed here? Well, we have here the total defeat of two enemy nations at the hands of God's people. Two kings who seem so powerful. King Og is so big that he needs a giant iron bed. He is a giant in the land. He had 60 cities under his command, didn't he? They had tall walls and gates. And yet they were no match for God's people when the Lord was on their side. Having shown them with the first three nations that God is the king of the world, he now shows them with these two kings that he is the one who gives the victory. Now, if you're anything like me, passages like this may well make us feel uncomfortable. As we see whole groups of people wiped out, whole nations destroyed with no one left, men, women and children killed at the hands of God's people, this is not something that we want to stop and look at or listen to. And I think in many ways that is a right reaction. But as we look on this and as we continue in Deuteronomy, I think there are a few things that we need to be clear on so that we don't get God wrong here. Firstly, we need to be clear that this is not a random killing of an innocent group of people. All the way back in Genesis chapter 15, when speaking to Abraham about giving this land, God says this. Genesis chapter 15, it says, in the fourth generation, your descendants will come back here. That's here, the promised land. For the sin of the Amorites has not yet reached its full measure. And if you flick over to Deuteronomy chapter 9, which we'll be looking at in a few weeks. Deuteronomy chapter 9, verse 4. It says this, after the Lord your God has driven them out before you, do not say to yourself, the Lord has brought me here to take possession of this land because of my righteousness. No, it is on account of the wickedness of these nations that the Lord is going to drive them out before you. These nations that God hands over to his people here were far from innocent. We see elsewhere that they were taking part in awful practices, including child sacrifice, in the worship of other gods. And so here we see that actually the destruction of these nations was God bringing about his right judgment on sinful people by using his own nation to do that. At the same time, God was also beginning to remove from the promised land all opposition to himself. The land that these two kings occupied was actually just inside the promised land. And so in giving these nations over to his people, God was doing away with all rebellion in his kingdom. We see elsewhere that the promised land was to be a place where God's people lived with God, free from opposition, without God's enemies around them, that would lead them astray to worship other gods, so that they might be God's holy people, people who worship him and live for him. But for that to happen, all opposition to God's rule must be done away with. And when we put it like that, we start to see that as God brings about judgment on these nations, this is a picture, it's a foreshadowing of a day that is to come, where judgment will fall on sinful people and all opposition to God's rule will be done away with completely, so that God's people can live with him in his good land, enjoying the blessing of life with him. Here, as we look on the destruction of these nations, we're meant to see just how serious sin is. We're meant to see what sin deserves, God's right, just punishment of the wicked and their rejection of him. We don't like looking at this here, do we? And that is right. But these pictures help us to not lose sight of how serious sin is, to not lose sight of what does await those who reject God's right rule and oppose his people. There is coming a day when the wicked will be punished, and it is not something that we want anyone to face. This is to remind us that we want to be found on God's side on that day. Well, as God's people are reminded of the victory that God gave them over these nations, as they look at the land that they already have in the promised land, if you read chapter 3, 12 to 17, which we didn't have chance to read, you see that God divides this land between some of his people. As they look on these victories, what are they to learn? Well, look with me to chapter 3, verse 21. At that time I commanded Joshua, "You have seen with your own eyes all that the Lord your God has done to these two kings. The Lord will do the same to all the kingdoms over there where you are going. Do not be afraid of them. The Lord your God himself will fight for you." These victories are almost to act like a dress rehearsal in the past, to help God's people to trust him in the future, to see that God has already given over to them powerful nations. And so he will do the same again in the future, so they don't need to fear the future. God is the king of the whole world, and they don't need to fear the future. He will be by their side and will give the victory just as he has done up until now. God has been graciously teaching this new generation, just as he did the previous one, that he will keep his promises. He will give them this land to bring them into the promised rest if they take him at his word and step out in obedience. And so as we come to the end of this recap, the first three chapters of Deuteronomy, or almost a recap of what's gone on before, we're meant to be left asking the question, well, what happens next? Will God's people trust his promises? Will they take possession of the land? Will they learn from these gracious lessons here? They seem to have done so much better than the first generation. As we've read through chapters 2 and 3, I don't know if you noticed how every time God gives them a command and they take him at his word and they are obedient. He said, don't attack, and they didn't. When he said, I've given you this nation, they went up and fought. Could this be the nation that finally entered the rest that the last generation missed out on? Will they trust God, drive out the nations, and live with God free from opposition? Well, I think chapter 3, verses 21 to 29, that final episode with Moses, gives us a clue of where the story is heading. As Moses pleads to be allowed to enter the land, but because of his sin and the sin of his people, he misses out on the blessing of entering the land. Even Moses, who trusted God and believed his word again and again, who remembered that what God was like when the rest of God's people didn't, even he couldn't enter the land because of the sin of the people and because of his own sin. We see in Numbers, where we read this account, that Moses himself had his own sin. He struck the rock when he wasn't meant to, and the Lord said, for that reason, you will not enter the land. And so as Joshua takes over the baton to lead God's people, we're left wondering, will he fare any better? Will God's people listen to him? Will they keep trusting God? Well, the answer comes as no surprise to us, does it? Deuteronomy is a call for God's people to choose life, to live in obedience to God's good commands, that they may know the blessing of life with him. And yet listen to Moses' words in Deuteronomy 31, verse 29. Before they've even stepped into the land, Moses says this, I know that after my death, you are sure to become utterly corrupt and to turn from the way I have commanded you. In days to come, disaster will fall on you because you will do evil in the sight of the Lord and arouse his anger by what your hands have made. This same generation, Moses says, actually, you have that same sin problem that the previous generation did. And the Bible is full of this cycle, isn't it? God rescues his people. He gives them all that they need, graciously providing for them. And yet they turn from him, rebel against him, reject him, because his rescued people have the same sin problem. It is a pattern as old as the Old Testament. We see it with Noah. Noah is rescued through the flood, and yet we see Noah has the same sin problem. The book of Judges is full of it. Even David and Solomon, those who were to lead God's people in his ways, well, they have the same sin problem themselves. And that's what we see here in Moses 2. And so the uncomfortable truth that becomes more and more clear as we go further and further into Deuteronomy is that the judgment we see God's people exercise here over the two kings is the same judgment that they deserve for their rebellion. And as we look on this evening, we're to see that we're no different. The problem when we often read the Old Testament is that we love to put ourselves in the place of the hero of the story, don't we? We love to see ourselves as Moses or David or someone like that. And yet the message of the Bible is that it would be much more accurate to say we ourselves are just like God's unfaithful, rebellious people. As I'm outraged at their rebellion against the Lord, I need to look at my own heart and see that same rebellion again and again, rejecting God's word, thinking that I know better, saying with my actions, you're evil, God. You don't want what's best for me. You want to spoil my fun. What you're telling me brings death. Actually, I think brings life. That's what I'm like every day. And so the question that comes is, will God's people ever enter this promised rest? To live with God and enjoy the blessing of life with him, free from opposition. God's people never did drive out all the surrounding nations, and their hearts were led astray by other nations and other gods again and again. It all seems so hopeless, but despite their rebellion, despite our rebellion, God in his grace didn't give up on his promises. Until there came another leader of God's people, one like Moses, on his knees, praying that he might not face God's judgment for the sin of his people, who, like Moses, was obedient when the answer came back no, who prayed, "Not my will, but yours be done." One who himself was in the wilderness 40 days and yet remained faithful, who perfectly obeyed his father's commands, even to the point of death. And yet, unlike Moses, didn't have his own sin to bear, but willingly faced the judgment that his people deserved. Who, like King Sihon and Og, faced God's right anger at sin, but it was not his own sin. Who was himself the king of the whole world, and yet allowed himself to be put to death, to pay the price for sinful rebellion in his death. And yet he did not stay dead. He rose from the grave victorious, defeating our great enemies, sin, death, and Satan, in order that he might give us his own spotless righteousness, his perfect record, his sinless life, and by his atoning death, wash us clean by his blood, to present us before the Father, holy and blameless in his sight, so that we might not fear the future, because it is certain for all those trusting in Jesus, won through his death and his resurrection, that we will enter that perfect rest, that the promises were pointing forward to, looking past the land of Canaan to the good land, the new creation, where all opposition to God's rule will be gone, cast out of his presence, all signs of sin and the fall gone. Sickness, death, disease will be done away with completely, and we will live with God in his presence and worship him for the wonder of his grace to us in Jesus. As we share communion in a few minutes, we declare this glorious truth to ourselves and to each other. As surely as we eat the bread and drink the wine, Jesus has dealt with our sin at the cross, bearing our punishment in his own body. He has washed us clean by his blood to bring us to God. So we do not need to fear the future, because the King of the whole world is in control. He's done it all, and he will surely bring us home. Physical reminders of that glorious truth, of how amazingly gracious our God is with sinners like us. Grace, a welcome from the Father. Grace, forgiveness, full and free. Grace that's greater than our failings. Oh, there is grace awaiting me.